Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. What goes better together than red beans and rice? How about hot ham and cold beer? If that sounds as good to you as it does to me, we've got just the ticket for you on this week's show. First, we'll taste Chisasi Brothers' spicy new Cajun meats and hear the delicious story of their 100-plus-year-old family history from fifth-generation Nicholas Chisasi and his dad, Philip. Once we've whittled that ham down to the bone, we'll cook it up in a big pot of Camellia red beans to celebrate the opening of the Red Bean City exhibit at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Camellia's fourth-generation CEO, Vince Hayward, joins us for the party. And then we'll wash all that goodness down with an icy cold Dixie beer as we learn how that iconic brand returned to barrooms and grocery store shelves everywhere. Finally, author David Capello takes us back in time to Schwagman Brothers Giant Supermarket, the place where you could always get your Chisasi ham, Camellia beans, and drink a cold Dixie right there in the store. We're making groceries just like your mom and them did on this week's Louisiana Eats. Out on Jefferson Highway, there's a meatpacking company that's as much of a New Orleans institution as Leidenheimer bread and blue plate mayonnaise. Can you guess who we're talking about? It's the place where the ham comes from for your perfect ham poor boy. Chisasi Brothers.
Sometimes we say the name Chisasi. You've had Chisasi ham and people say, I don't know. I said, the little pig. Oh yes, we've had that product.
For over 100 years, Chisasi Brothers' Southern-style smoked meat products have been staples in homes, grocery stores, and restaurants throughout the South. Parkway Bakery and Dookie Chase Restaurant are just a few of their satisfied customers.
I'm going to stay on this side. It's kind of slick. Just stay to this side.
Fifth-generation family member Nicholas Chisasi gave us a tour of their operation, where he and his three siblings maintain the Chisasi tradition under the watchful eye of their octogenarian father, Philip.
Since 1908, huh?
1908.
How are y'all going to celebrate 110 years?
I don't know. Hopefully we get drunk.
The business has certainly been through a lot of changes since its humble beginnings selling live chickens in the New Orleans French market. Following our tour of the plant, Nicholas introduced us to the patriarch of the family, his father, Philip.
That's my dad.
And the two of them filled us in on the remarkable story of Chisasi Brothers Meats.
My name is Nicholas Chisasi, fifth generation of Chisasi Brothers Meatpacking Company here in New Orleans.
My name is Philip Chisasi, and my position is that I'm owner of Chisasi Brothers at this time. I'm the fourth generation, and they're the fifth generation behind me.
1908 is when we really, I guess, started keeping track of everything, but we started out selling chickens, believe it or not, live in the French Quarter, and the French market is exactly how it actually started.
I'm 81, so the furthest I can remember was on Decatur and Ursuline, who sold live chickens, ducks, rabbits, geese. I was born in French Quarter. I went to St. Mary's School around the corner, St. Mary's Italian School.
Did you know you knew your grandfather?
I knew my grandfather. I used to help him make chicken coops that they used to go catch your chickens with. And when you go on a farm, they had a house, and you used to go catch the chickens on the house and put them in the cage, put them on a truck to bring them down here. We were living on Conti Street when we had as far as live chickens, we was distributing to different people when we brought them in on a truck. Then from Quantine Street, we went to, I think it was Gov Nichols, and then we sold dressed chickens out of there. But I used to go to Aloysius School, and after school, I used to go to the business and start cutting chickens and putting them in a box. And it's, I was, I guess, about maybe 15, 16 years old.
And you graduated from high school and went straight into the business?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I became a salesman, and then I was going out and sell the product. It was not only chickens, it was eggs, hams. We bought the hams from Tupelo, Mississippi. I guess I was in my 20s when I was on the street.
And who were your customers?
At that time, they had a lot of mom and pop stores, I call them, that we used to sell. We had all the restaurants, Antoine's and that we sold to restaurants, and Swagman was a good account for us.
Were there any particular customers back in the day that you used to just love to go call on?
Well, there was a bunch of customers like that. I mean, you got personal friendship with them and that, and you go in there to get an order, and at that time, you used to have other salesmen from Swift, Carterhead, or wherever the packing house was coming from, and you used to have little contests of flipping a kernel or something to buy a soft drink or something like that. I mean, so it goes back a long way.
When did the profile of your products, how did that evolve and change? What drove those changes?
Well, you had more chicken houses coming, and we was a middleman, more or less. And they kind of went in directly to these big stores and start selling these big stores. And the little mom and pop stores wasn't there anymore that I could sell.
So then they started doing some beef, and then they started doing some cutting and trimming of the meat, making of sausages and stuff like that, and it went from there.
Then we moved to Galvis and La Perouse. It was an old ice house at one time.
And where's that? What part, what neighborhood is that?
That's not far from Dookie Chase's restaurant, right up in that area.
Yeah.
So we were there for a long time, and it was kind of like if people hear the name and people in the neighborhood, and we used to do hot dogs and stuff like that at the time. So the kids would come by and they'd get a hot dog, and the kids kind of remembered that. So it was just one of those things. And then a gentleman one day came along and said, you know, we could smoke some hams.
And then we started making our own hams on La Perouse and Galvis. Well, the ham is something that you want to, the way we do it, it's an old-fashioned way. It's a whole muscle ham. It's not ground up and then put in a foam, because every time you look at one of them hams, you see they're all the same shape.
Mm-hmm.
You know hams ain't the same shape.
No, pigs don't come in the same shape, do they?
No. So that's why ours is a little different. Yes, it's different little shapes now and then that we keep it in. And that's the hardest part, to try to keep that, because when you get new employees, you got to form it the right way.
We still do it the same way, the way that the product is handled, the way that the product's injected, and the way it's smoked, it's still all the same. We haven't changed that recipe. It's the way it's done. And the brahm that it's seasoned with, our flavor and that it's done with is our own. It's, you know, it's got a sweet, smoky taste at the same time, where some hams are more salt taken and, you know, have salt flavor and stuff like that. But ours is just, it is what it is. It's kind of like a New Orleans tradition to have that for Christmas, Easter, and Thanksgiving, that product.
Currently, your operation is located out in Elmwood. When did y'all make the move out there?
We went from the French Quarter. We moved into an old ice house on La Perouse and Galva Street. We kind of outgrew that neighborhood, and then we moved to Julia Street, 2419 Julia Street, right by the Superdome.
And then Washington Avenue, we had a plant that we used to take care of all the school beds. And then the storm came along and wiped us out.
So that I'm sure that was an absolutely insane time. It was for all of us, but y'all had quite a struggle too. As I understand, everybody's houses, the factory, everything, boom.
Right.
So it was kind of like the nuclear explosion, and you had to start over.
Right.
How did y'all set out to do that?
Well, we finally got back in after some time, and we was in Baton Rouge, basically, and we kept trying to get back because we knew that we was going to have a mess on our hands. I mean, everybody's refrigerators smelt. We had walk-in refrigerators, so it was even a bigger mess. Right, correct. So, and we did a commercial after saying, if you think your refrigerator stunk, you can just imagine what ours was like.
We had 2 million, 2.5 million pounds of meat we threw away.
Oh, my gosh.
You should have smelled that.
I'm glad I didn't, honestly.
So my dad at the time was like, you know, the cavalry's not coming. What are we going to do here? And, you know, what do y'all want to do? We can basically throw the towel in or we can keep on going. And we decided that we wanted to continue on. And so he said, nobody's coming to help us. We got to get in and do it ourselves.
It was about 9 people that really took us 3 weeks to clean up.
So we got down and we just started throwing everything out, doing what we had to do to sanitize, calling up to see, hey, we want to be back up in an operation. We can't wait. And everything was so hard to get people to try to get an answer from, you know, the state and this and everybody else to say, okay, we want to start and operate and, you know, get back in operation. What do we need to do? We're cleaning up stuff. We're repairing the roof. We're getting refrigeration. We're getting everything done. And the big thing was my dad was big driven on trying to get some normalcy back to the people in New Orleans. And, you know, if you have Thanksgiving, that's what we were shooting for, is to have the product back on the table for people for Thanksgiving. So that's what we shot out to do, and that's what we did. 2 weeks before, we were back up and running.
Well, that's kind of a miracle. How did you get the equipment and everything?
Well, it was a lot of work. And when we had like 7, we had family members and about 4 or 5 friends of the family that were there every day and pushing through and getting it done. And just, you know, basically we was focused on a game plan and we had to get it done. So we just got it done.
There must have been some tokens of gratitude that came your way.
Well, they're still buying the product and they're supporting us. And the reason why we are where we are is because of the people that, you know, support that product. It really is the people that drive us.
We got thanks all the way from Texas. Texas. And further than Texas, that people will call up.
Anything stand out in your mind that anybody had to say?
Well, you know, this is hard to believe, but I had a guy fly in from Hawaii to buy the hams. Now, he had his own plan, and the guy to come to buy the hams, I said, you come that far and with the pilot. And I said, I'll give you a couple of hams.
That's incredible. Was he a New Orleanian?
Yeah. That was really something.
Of course, any business to survive and thrive has to evolve. How rare is it for you all to introduce a new product?
It's very rare because it's hard to try to get my father to change. This is the way we do it. We do it the same way every day and don't change. But we took the opportunity because of the Cajun product. To me, has been misrepresented in many ways as being hot and spicy. To me, Cajun flavoring is a bold taste. You taste it, and then it kind of fades away and goes away. So we wanted to get it right. So we decided that we was going to come out with a product like that. So we went to Tony Sacheri's seasoning, which is known and throughout as Creole seasoning. And, you know, it took a little doing, but we got it worked out to where we can co-brand with them. And I think it's just taken 2 Louisiana iconic names, merging them together to support the state of Louisiana and to go out there and to just sell Louisiana, because there's nothing like food that's in Louisiana.
And what does Dad say? Did Dad have to be persuaded, or did he just take a taste and go along with the project?
He was sold on first taste.
So you've been working in the business, well, let's see, about 75, 76 years now, huh?
Somewhere in that neighborhood.
You started when you... I hear you come here every day.
Yes, I do. I come here in the morning. I'm starting to leave a little early in the evening, though.
Oh, you're cutting yourself a little slack after all these years. Do you suppose you'll ever retire?
What would I do?
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. This has been such an honor and a pleasure having a chance to sit down with you.
Keep pushing. That's all I can say.
Philip Chisasi and Nicholas Chisasi, fourth and fifth generation owners and operators of Chisasi Brothers Meats. When we come back from a short break, we're washing down that hot Cajun ham with a cold Dixie beer. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets and from Cafe B, featuring contemporary Creole cuisine with an emphasis on fresh Gulf seafood, served in a classic Old Metairie setting. Lunch, dinner, Sunday brunch, and private events on Metairie Road. Do you remember Dixie beer?
We bet you like those lights, signs, and clocks that advertise beer in your neighborhood tavern. At the Dixie Brewing Company, we do too, and wish we could put up a few. But we're a small hometown brewery, and, well, we just plain can't afford to. But that doesn't mean there isn't lots of cold Dixie beer in your tavern cooler. Ask for it. 100% pure, certified premium. That's our sign.
Though this old commercial feels like a distant memory, it wasn't long ago that Dixie was New Orleans' very own lager, as emblematic of the Crescent City as legendary New Orleans clarinetist Pete Fountain.
Well, I started playing music really because of the brewery. Working over here with Dad, the cases were so heavy that I figured my clarinet was a lot lighter.
Well, he was a good little helper.
Dixie, that's my beer.
Fortunately, Dixie beer is no longer a relic. Thanks to the Benson family of Saints football fame, the classic New Orleans beer is back on tap in the same watering holes where many of us had our very first taste. We sat down with Ben Hales, Senior Vice President of Marketing and Business Development at Saints headquarters on Airline Drive, to learn more about what Dixie signified in the past and what it means today.
Really, I guess the story, not to go too far back, really started after Katrina came back, and there were a lot of different opportunities to develop, and Mr. Benson saw a lot of the promised developments not happening. So he decided to broaden those horizons a little bit more and say, what other opportunities can we lend our strengths to potentially save, bring back, invest in? And Dixie beer, while, you know, was certainly at the top of the list, after a long courtship, the Bruno family agreed to sell the majority to Mr. Benson and trust us to rejuvenate the brand and bring it back. And here we are with Dixie beer back on the shelves about 2 years after the whole process started.
The Brunos had not particularly been interested in selling Dixie previously.
No, they haven't been. And I will tell you that you've never met a couple that's fought harder to save a brand. You look at all these old New Orleans beers, they're the last ones left standing. And that was truly a labor of love, and what they were able to do to save it, to get to the point where we could step in and bring it to the next level. I think the real challenge for them, they'd still be out there fighting today had they not lost the brewery during Katrina, and then everything that happened after that with the VA and that not being an option to go back to at this point. It just, I think it became too much of a hill to climb, but they wanted somebody who looked at it the same way, that you're guardians of the brand. You're not the owner of the beer. This is really, it's New Orleans beer, and you've got to look at it as a community asset in a lot of ways. And they always looked at it that way, and they wanted somebody who would look at it the same way. I think we're realistic. You know, I don't think Mr. Benson plans on getting rich off Dixie beer. It's about preserving something that mattered to him. I mean, he one thing we love about Dixie beer, anytime you talk to someone about this project, they tell you their Dixie beer story. They tell about their family. They tell you their personal story. I talk about my friends and where we drink Dixie beer and in college. I won't say high school, but everybody has that story, and it's immediately told with a smile on their face.
Well, my dad has a picture of me, like when I was like 5 years old, like sitting on his lap, and I've got his Dixie beer like like I'm drinking it, you know, like 45 years ago, somewhere around there. Yeah, this picture is my dad and all his friends sitting around tables with like pyramids of Dixie beers.
Oh yeah, Grandpa's favorite beer was Dixie. He had a Dixie beer cake when I was growing up. I think I was probably, I don't know, maybe 6 or 7. He had a birthday cake one year, and they had it decorated as a Dixie beer label. And I got a picture of him holding me in one hand and the beer cake in the other hand. So probably the first time I drank a Dixie beer, I was probably around 5 or 6, you know? Yeah, for real.
Well, Mr. Benson himself has memories. Back in the day when the drinking was 18, pretty much if you could reach the bar in New Orleans, you were allowed a cold Dixie. And so he has memories of that from his youth as well.
Oh, absolutely. He tells the story, and I think the first time he was telling the story is, well, I probably started drinking when I was 16. He goes, you know what, it might have been 14. We said, Mr. Benson, keep it to 16, please. I don't know what the statute of limitations is on underage drinking in New Orleans, but I think they've probably expired. But he would talk about where he would drink it, the restaurants, what he'd eat with it, and that's the same thing. Any of us here that grew up here would say the same thing. Well, I used to get it here, and I'd eat it. You know, we'd go to this po' boy place, and I'd always get my Dixie beer there. And you just take turns telling stories about your personal experience with Dixie beer.
When you need a beer that's cool and smooth, just tell them,
give me a Dixie.
At the end of the day, what we bought were recipes and a brand. And memories and stories, and there wasn't any property left. There wasn't a brewery to buy. Much of even the records were lost during Katrina because the flood was so devastating on Tulane Avenue that a lot of those things that would have been great to have went away. Fortunately, they preserved the recipes in a couple of safe places, and it was a pretty special day when those were delivered to us in a sparkling folder by Joseph and Kendra Bruno, and were entrusted with those, and we immediately read them. We didn't understand half of what was going on. We've learned a lot more since then, but it's fun to have custody of something that's so special.
You went and found someone who would understand that, though, your brewmaster. Tell us about your brewmaster, because even though Dixie isn't being brewed here in New Orleans yet, as I've heard from a lot of people, at least it's moving down river towards us. So tell us about that.
We're getting closer. Well, Kevin Stewart is our brewmaster, and he was Dixie's brewmaster prior to Katrina and had been with Dixie Beer for 20-something years, I believe. And pretty sure we had the right guy. And the first day we met him, he was wearing a Saints hat that was practically rotting off of his head. So we knew he was a big Saints fan. We knew he was a local who understood this. And in fact, once we finally got our first brew off the ground, I had to replace his Saints hat as a gesture of appreciation. And I think it was hard to peel the old one off his head. But his attention to detail is second to none. Every step of the way, his questions were, when am I, you know, how often are you setting me my test? How often are we tasting this together? Making sure their equipment was top of the line, that he just doesn't cut any corners. And if it's not perfect, you start all over again. So it gave us a lot of confidence that we were going to produce the kind of beer that people fell in love with.
What has been the reaction from the marketplace? What have you been hearing from consumers, from the beer drinkers?
I think one of the most fun things that we've done through this process is, you know, Mr. Benson gets excited about these things, and at the end of a couple of days, he's like, well, why don't we go out and see how the beer's doing? And we've stopped by some places like Fat Harry's or Avenue Pub or at Parkway the other night, and hearing directly from people, the statement that we hear the most that we love is, this is the beer I fell in love with. Dixie beer tastes great again.
Where do you see Dixie beer's place into the beer drinking landscape?
Well, you know, as we look at Louisiana and beer drinking in general, and you look at this huge craft beer market that's in the rest of the country, Louisiana's really lagged behind that. I mean, I think I saw a statistic recently where we're 49 out of 50 states. And if you look at the history of New Orleans was one of the greatest brewing cities in the world, and certainly the capital of brewing in the South. So when we look at it, we're trying to make that industry stronger. We joined the Louisiana Craft Brewers Guild recently. We're going to do whatever we can to help assist that industry. The way we look at it is Dixie Beer's been around since 1907, but we want to see all of these breweries do really well. There's no reason that with all the tourism, all the great the culinary tradition that we have here, beer should be at the top of that list too. And we have so many creative people who really understand taste and quality. If we can help sustain and grow that industry, that would be a huge win for us.
There's nothing more southern than a Friday night dance. Nothing more southern than a pretty girl's glance. Nothing more southern than a good game of chance. And nothing more southern than Dixie.
Ben Hales of the New Orleans Saints, and now, Dixie Beer. Dixie's back in bars, restaurants, and groceries across New Orleans. Dish is the most emblematic of New Orleans. Some might say gumbo, some etouffee, others might suggest crawfish or jambalaya, but most, like our very own jazz great Louis Armstrong would say, red beans and rice. Louis loved them so much, every letter he wrote was signed, "Red Beans and Ricely Yours." When it comes to red beans, no one knows beans better than Vince Hayward, fourth-generation owner and CEO of Camellia Beans. We toured Camellia's new exhibit at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum with Vince to hear his unique perspective on all things red bean.
Yeah. What we've done is put together an exhibit, and the idea was to depict the cultural significance of the dish of red beans and rice to the city of New Orleans. It's really something that's become synonymous with the city and sort of woven into the fabric of our culture.
So I see the year 1836. Take us back to 1836 and tell us how the red bean story begins for Camellia Brand.
So in 1836, one of my great-great-grandfathers was in Bermuda for some reason, and he decided to come to America. And he landed in New Orleans. As we surmise, his travels took him from Europe through the Caribbean up into the city, and it was there that he really discovered dishes that were bean-centric, and particularly red beans. That dish really came out of Africa, and as the flow of trade came from Africa up through the Caribbean into the United States, New Orleans and anyone in that region would have been very familiar with those types of beans and ultimately that dish.
So it begins with Sawyer Hayward, your great-great, however many greats, grandfather.
Yeah.
But the bean story really picks up in 1913.
Yeah, so as a family, we were always in the trade of agriculture. We transported goods and products to New Orleans, to the merchants in the French market. And over the years, that's been everything from onions to almonds to, of course, beans and every type of edible agriculture. As you know, as the family just began to put down roots over the last couple centuries, our line of business and products have kind of just slowly whittled themselves down to dried beans.
So from 1913, when Lucius Hamilton Jr. starts in the food trade working for the National Biscuit Company, he finally decides to have his own business then, yes?
In 1913, he went to work for the National Biscuit Company. It was where he learned the grocery business. He learned the value of branding as the retail grocery trade began to get away from things like general stores, mom and pops, and slowly we began to get to the idea of supermarkets. He decided that he would have his own brand. So when it came time to come up with a brand name, one of my grandmother's favorite flowers was the camellia. At a time when horticulture really meant some type of prominence or wealth, if you had money to decorate your home with nice plants and things like that, It gave a feeling or sort of a symbolic testament that these were products for people that really demanded the best and wanted something that was a little extra. The next part of the exhibit is just kind of a depiction of what beans in a grocery store would look like starting in 1927. And there's also some open barrels here with some beans that provides an interactive opportunity for kids or adults really to just kind of run their fingers through the beans. It's really sort of addictive.
So fun. But sadly, the fun of scooping the beans out of the barrel was something that went away with the little mom and pop stores, the old traditional stores.
World War II was a very pivotal point in our society. It was kind of the advent of consumerism, and with that, the supermarket. And in the city of New Orleans, Schwegman Brothers was the first hometown hero, local player, very famous purveyors of groceries, and really notable for their giant concept stores, really huge footprints. At one point in history, their aisles were so wide that they could drive trucks down the aisles and deliver directly from the truck onto the shelf, which just sort of depicted the massive amounts of commerce that was going on in these stores. Certainly, it was a very pivotal part in our history. We realized that we had to get very good at packaging beans and branding beans. And it was about 1947 when we fully transitioned into package, an experience that the consumers would have if they would reach onto the shelf, pick up our package of beans, and it would make a very distinctive...
There's that crinkling sound.
Crinkling noise. Cellophane is a plant fiber, and we packaged all of our beans in a very clear, crinkly, rigid film. And it gave us a very distinct and unusual presence. We don't use cellophane anymore, but over the years, we've been very careful to keep that crinkly, rigid feel, tactile part of our packaging.
Well, it's just so nice to be able to look through and see the product.
Well, it's true. I mean, I can't tell you how many discussions we've had in our office about how clear the film is. Is it clear enough? Is it providing us, the consumers, a really open window into what they're buying? And over the years, it's also driven a necessity on our part to make sure that the beans in the bags are as perfect as they can be, because we don't hide behind a big label, and we're just sort of out there for the whole world to see. What that instilled in us is just an absolute dedication to the quality of what goes in there. One of the things that drives that quality is the generational relationships we have with our farmers and our growers. And, you know, my grandfather did business with their grandfather. And whenever harvest comes, you know, only the best quality are set aside, because they know, they've learned a long time ago that we won't accept anything that's not absolutely perfect.
From the early beginnings at the French Market, where has the company moved throughout the city?
So fortunately, we've only had to move two times. We went from the French Market to our first warehouse production facility in the early 20s, which at the time was located on South Front Street. That street now is called Convention Center Boulevard.
That's a big change.
Yeah, and our building was there until the early 80s when it was demolished to make room for the World's Fair. From there, we went to Elmwood. So we're in an Elmwood industrial area near the Huey P. Long Bridge. We're right next to the river. We chose that area because it was a good location for trucks and rail cars to come in and deliver the products to us, and trucks to carry the products back out to the retailers and the distribution centers. But those are the only two buildings we've ever been in other than the French Market.
Why do you believe we eat red beans on Monday in New Orleans?
Well, first of all, it's just a fantastic tradition, right? And like all traditions, their roots are sometimes not exactly clear. But the most predominant explanation has been about wash day. And traditionally, the lady of the house did the wash, the cleaning, much of the manual labor on Monday. And because beans are such a hearty food item, that they can cook hours upon hours. So it made sense to cook these beans hours upon hours, freeing her up to do the rest of her work while dinner was being made. And then once she's finished and exhausted and completely kaput, there they were, ready to feed the family. Maybe it's becoming a little bit outdated in modern times, but we haven't come up with a better one. The dish of red beans and rice is something that unites people across all colors, all race, all ethnicity, all income levels, you know. No matter where you live in this city, chances are you eat red beans and rice. And, you know, Miss Leah Chase tells great stories of people coming to her restaurant in the times of civil rights strife and the dish they would enjoy as people came to discuss their differences and their ideas was they would sit down and have a plate of red beans and rice together. Also, people have fond memories of serving red beans that their grandmother cooked or maybe to their children and things like that. So for these reasons, it's a dish that's important to us as a society and a culture, and we wanted an opportunity to celebrate that, and the Southern Food and Beverage Museum just provided the perfect venue.
What are your red beans like? What's the secret ingredient in the Hayward pot of red beans?
Part of my experience with red beans growing up was that because it's our recipe on the back of the bag, we felt like, on the back of the package, I should say, we felt like it was important that we stick to that recipe. If we're gonna tell people that this is the proper way to cook red beans, that's the way we're gonna eat them. And both my parents always felt strongly about that. Growing up, that's how we made them, exactly what's on the back of the package. We used smoke ham hocks and cooked them a long time till they got real soft and creamy, and I'm getting hungry just thinking about it.
Do you ever get tired of red beans?
Of course not.
Well, Vince, thank you so much for both walking us through Red Bean City and doing your part along with your family to make sure New Orleans stays Red Bean City Central.
Well, thank you, Poppy. It's been a great pleasure, and you're such a treasure, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Vince Hayward, owner and CEO of the L.H. Hayward Camellia Bean Company. What does it mean for a product to be officially certified Cajun? And how does a product get certified in the first place? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and from French Market Coffee. French Market Coffee's premium blended beans are locally roasted in small batches, creating a coffee that can only be called New Orleans bold. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What does it mean for a product to be officially certified Cajun? And how does a product get certified? The Certified Cajun Program is administered by the Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry. To be certified Cajun, or Creole, your product must be grown, processed, or packaged in Louisiana. There are currently over 400 products bearing that distinction, which comes complete with an official logo displayed proudly on the packaging. Those products range from rice to seasonings to seafood and are guaranteed to carry our authentic flavors across the globe. I'm Poppy Tooker, and certified Cajun products are real Louisiana Eats.
My name is David Capello, and I'm the author of The People's Grocer, John G. Schwegman, New Orleans, and the Making of the Modern Retail World.
There are many buildings across New Orleans that still bear the names of forgotten businesses. Though some of the signs that once read Schwegman's are long gone, the city's original grocery empire is not forgotten. David Capella's biography of John G. Schwegman paints the portrait of a grocer who helped to create the modern supermarket. When John G. took over his father's simple food store, people began making groceries in a whole new way. David reflected back on these early times at Schwegman's.
Well, those were unique days in the grocery store business. It was completely different than it is now. There were no real brands. There was just barrels and bags and such things for commodities, and people had to come and bring their own containers and walk to the store and walk back to their homes. And when they got to the store, they were just waited on individually by a clerk.
When John G. took the reins and opened his first giant supermarket in 1946, the experience of shopping was quickly modernized to keep up with post-war development across the country.
It was a very well-done store, and it was highly successful. And he ended up managing the store on Piety and Burgundy for almost half a century, 50 years.
That's practically an eon in retail years. The loyal shoppers of Schwegman's had plenty to get used to as John G. transformed the grocery store business. David tells us a story about one shopper's reaction to the changes.
How am I supposed to get around this puzzle garden? I want you to wait on me. There's no way I can find anything. And he handed her a bag and said, "Well, you're on your own now." And she said, "No way am I going to do this." He's like, "Well, that's fine." And he took the bag and got all her things and came back and said, "Okay, here's your price, and I'm adding 10% service charge." And then she threw a fit. And from then on, it was self-service after that.
When John Schwegman opened the first Schwegman Brothers giant grocery on Airline Highway, not only was it really giant, it was filled with amazing innovations, including an air-conditioned bar located in the front of the store, where dads could cool their heels with a cold Dixie beer while mom made groceries.
He had the cheapest highballs in the country, apparently.
Oh, really?
And a lot of the locals would go out to Schwegman's to get away from the tourists, because none of the tourists could even conceive, like you said, that there was a bar in a supermarket.
Along with being able to imbibe while making groceries, customers would often come across the store's live inhabitants.
Yeah, they used to have live animals that they would render for the customers. And John Francis, the son, would come in to work on a Sunday morning or whatever while no one was in there, and he could hear the bullfrogs chirping all over the store.
Was this on Airline?
Yes.
The bullfrogs were saying knee deep on Airline.
Yes.
It adds to the exoticism. All of that and a cold beer right in the store, too.
Cold beer and oyster shell parking lot and all sorts of things.
Schwegman's was truly one of a kind. At the height of his success, John G. Schwegman did something most titans of industry would never do. He became satisfied with his lot.
Yeah, that's one of the great mysteries and great inspirations behind this whole Schwegman story, is that you don't really hear about that anymore these days, about deciding that you've made enough money.
After making his fortune, Mr. Schwegman set his sights on two other lofty goals, becoming a local politician and traveling the world. He began to share his philosophical and worldly discoveries with customers through his grocery store ads.
Where instead of just having a weekly ad that promotes his bargains at the store, he starts talking about his political beliefs and his morality and just whatever is on his mind. Now, he started world traveling. He had a passion for travel. He loved going on steamship voyages to Europe and eventually all over the world. So when he first started doing this, he decided to publish in his supermarket ads these kind of extended blog posts telling about his fantastic travels to Europe, and goes through like 10 different countries and talks about everything that happened, and very entertaining.
At this time, John G. Schwegman stepped back from the business just as his son was poised to take over. Unfortunately, the changing consumer landscape signaled the decline of the stores.
Well, it took a lot more time than that to unwind. It didn't unwind overnight. And the thing about it is I think he kind of lost focus on his stores. And so when the time came for John, his son, to take over the stores, they were not at the, you know, optimal tip-top peak. And he really couldn't go on. And at that point, his son took over, who had been groomed to
He'd
take over.
He'd been in the store with the bullfrog since he was 10.
Yeah. So he was primed and ready to go. Now, he expanded outside of the city, unlike what his father had ever wanted to do. And it was great. It worked out great. And except at the same time, there was the rise of Walmart and Kmart, and they all got into the food business, and there was more supermarkets coming into the city. And so the son faced a lot more competition than the father. So anyway, he had quite the challenge to keep the store empire going.
Well, it's a sad tale, because we sure all miss making groceries at Schwegman's. I want to thank you so much for chronicling our history so efficiently and effectively, and for sharing the story of the People's Grocer with our Louisiana Eats audience. So thank you. Thank you so much, David.
Oh, thank you, Poppy.
David Capello, author of The People's Grocer.
I was feeling nostalgic for the days when my thoughts slipped until my head from the ceiling. I remember the feeling.
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next week when author and blogger George Graham shares his obsession with Acadian culture and foodways.
I want to shake the hand of the man who caught the fish or cleaned the turtle. I want to know who grew my sweet potatoes and what variety they are. And I think that that's one of the real keys to Cajun Creole cooking.
Have you missed an episode of Louisiana Eats? Hear today's show or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com, where you can also subscribe to the podcast and take us with you wherever you go. If you love Louisiana Eats, let others know and help like-minded Louisiana food lovers find our show by leaving a review on iTunes. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, French Market Coffee, and Rouse's Markets. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau, and from Tableau, Dickie Brennan's latest restaurant serving local Creole cuisine with a view of Jackson Square. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Special thanks to Dominique Massa, who provided the sound bites from vintage Dixie beer commercials for today's show. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Morris. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Don't forget to find our recipes and see what we're up to at poppytooker.com. You can check us out on Instagram and Facebook, too. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.